This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I am Jim Harold and so glad to be with you once again. Of all the paranormal phenomena out there, one of the strangest and one of the ones that has always fascinated me, but there never seemed to be a lot of information on it, is that of cattle mutilations. Well, thanks to our guest today, that picture has totally changed because he has a new book out and it is voluminous. And I have to say it must be the most significant work in this area, probably ever. The book is called Stalking the Herd, Unraveling the Cattle Mutilation Mystery. And our guest is Christopher O'Brien, author of said book. Since 1992, Christopher has investigated over 1,000 paranormal events reported in the San Luis Valley, located in south central Colorado and north central New Mexico. Working with law enforcement officials, ex-military, ranchers, and an extensive network of sky watchers from 1992 to 2002, he documented one of the most intense waves of unexplained activity ever reported from a single geographic region of North America. And again, I could go on and on about the work that he's done in this. He's released multiple books. He's a big guest on a lot of big programs, including Coast to Coast AM, of course, and he is a co-host of the popular radio program and podcast, The Paracast. And we're so glad to have him with us today. Christopher O'Brien, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me, Jim. Sorry we had little problems getting our schedules to line up, but here we are, and there you go.
There we are. We got together finally. That's the thing that counts. And thanks for your flexibility as well. Now, let's go back to the beginning. How did you first get introduced to this whole phenomena?
Well, I was a 10-year-old shopping on a Saturday in a Safeway with my mom in Bellevue, Washington, and we were getting ready to check out, and I looked down and saw one of these tabloid newspapers with this lurid headline, Flying Saucers Killed My Horse. And there was a pretty intriguing, compelling photograph of the carcass of Snippy, the horse. This would have been probably October 1967 when I saw this. This was my first exposure to the subject and also my first exposure to the San Luis Valley, where I ended up many years later living for 13 years. And, you know, it always kind of resonated in the back of my mind, this whole mystery. I felt it was very compelling. And of course I made my mom give me a dime or however much it cost to buy the little newspaper, much to her horror. And, I remember devouring the article before we even got home. And when I moved to the San Luis Valley in 1989, I spent a couple, 3 years getting myself situated there. It's an extremely remote area. It's one of the most remote areas in North America, in the lower 48 states. I was 60 miles from the nearest stoplight. I think it was one person for every 7 square miles there. It's the world's largest alpine valley, completely surrounded by mountains. And the little town, Crestone, where I lived, was about 30 or 40 miles north of where the Snippy case occurred. And, of course, I kind of remembered that, you know, from my childhood. And when I first got there, I started asking around ranchers and law enforcement and some of the locals about, you know, activity in the area. And I quickly realized that that wasn't going to engender me many new friends if I pushed the subject. And so I spent about 2 or 3 years getting my feet situated, and I became a writer for my local newspaper. And I gave a New Year's Eve party in 1992, December 31st, and evidently the town had experienced quite an amazing UFO sighting the last week of November. I was gone. I was gigging with a band I was playing with, so I missed it. But quite a number of people, I think 18, I interviewed at least 18 people about the event, and I thought, hey, this is perfect fodder for a newspaper article. And when I was talking to everybody at the end of the party about this sighting, somebody chimed in, oh, that was the same night there was a cattle mutilation down in Costilla County, which is a couple of counties south from where I was. And I was off to the races, and I'm still wondering why I have this dead cow around my neck, 20 some odd years later. So that's kind of how I got involved in this.
I think that when people think about this phenomena, generally, those of us interested in the paranormal, I think the thing that first comes to mind, little green men mutilating cattle for experimentation purposes. Do you think that's a gross misrepresentation and oversimplification?
Well, if only it was that simple, man. It would make my my life a lot easier and the life of a handful of investigators that have been unbiased and objective in their approach to trying to unravel this particular mystery. Hence the subtitle of my book, Unraveling the Cattle Mutilation Mystery. This is a Gordian knot that is not, there's no one-size-fits-all answer. A lot of these cases, I think, are misidentified scavenger action, kind of a natural process that occurs to livestock when they die out in the range or out in the pastures of the world. And when the media gets involved and perhaps, let's say, true cases occur and it gets covered in the media, then every dead cow that an amateur, you know, just bystander happens to see appears to look high strange and unnatural in terms of its disfigurement. And as a result of a lot of work by a number of investigators over the years who have really, you know, promoted this whole idea that ETs are coming here to gather genetic material for whatever particular purpose or agenda they have, this has really become the pop culture go-to answer. And one of my prime motivations for writing this book was to dispel a lot of the pop culture programming and to really examine how this particular meme and culture has been propagated. And in the meantime, there's other theories too. I mean, you saw in the 70s lots of newspaper headlines and comments and quotes by law enforcement saying that they felt Satanists or occultists were involved. Ranchers were reporting hundreds, as it turns out, of mystery helicopter sightings that were seen in and around mutilation sites and areas where these animals were being reported, found in this condition. And I'm assuming, Jim, that your listeners know what a cattle mutilation is. It's a head of livestock that is found dead for no apparent reason. It's generally described as missing various soft tissue organs. Oftentimes, the tongue is gone, with the whole mandible flesh around the jaw has been taken away. Sometimes an eye, sometimes an ear. The reproductive organ or the reproductive tract of a cow is pulled out like a plug. The mammary glands, the udders, are gone. The genitalia on male animals is often found missing. And what's been most perplexing to, I think, the ranching community and law enforcement is there's no apparent clues left at the crime scene. So we have no tracks, oftentimes no tracks of the animal itself, no indication of coyotes or in tire tracks, cigarette butts, any sort of crime scene evidence to give the investigators a leg up on the situation. And this kind of, you know, boils over into thousands and thousands and thousands of reports over the years that we still are scratching our heads and trying to make heads or tails of this situation, pardon the pun. And you know, what I wanted to do when I set out to do this book was, first of all, to bring together all the databases that are out there that have been sitting there in the private sector. You know, very few people have had access to all this data. They've all been stovepipe, sort of unrelated to one another. And because, you know, I've been doing this for 20 years, I've made some inroads and made some friends and acquaintances within the research realm. And I'm really the first person. I'm the first person to bring all these databases together and put them in a timeline format. And at the same time, with the help of my mentor and very, very dear friend, David Perkins, who took me under his wing back in 93. And we've been riffing on this for decades. One of the things that he has helped immeasurably, obviously, is the research, but also to really expand my thinking and make a real concerted effort to follow each of the theories of how this, you know, who's behind these mutilation cases, follow each of the theories back to where they started. In other words, when did we first start thinking it was a cultist? When did we first start thinking it was a government? When did we first start thinking it was extraterrestrials? When did we first start being able to refute the debunkers and the skeptics who say all these cases, all 100% of these cases are misidentified scavenger action. Nothing to see here. You true believers, move along. So the book has really made an attempt to look at all these theories in a dispassionate, unbiased, objective manner, with no preconceptions. You know, we're throwing this against the wall and seeing what sticks. And in the meantime, I also wanted to put our relationship with cattle into a context as it relates to the unexplained livestock death phenomenon. And so I really literally start the book 30,000 years ago with some of the first images painted, artistic depictions of anything. Some of the earliest depictions by man are of extinct aurochs, or the progenitor breed or race of animals that gave us, you know, 943 breeds of cattle representing 1.37 billion head of livestock on the planet. And so by starting at the beginning, look at our sacred relationship with bulls and cows, how the relationship with the bull sort of went to the west and they were venerated, how the relationship with the cow went to the east, into India. Trying to place this mystery into a cultural context was very, very important to me.
Now, on that point, when you look at cattle mutilations worldwide, is there a nexus and are there places where they just don't occur?
Well, I can tell you where they do occur. They occur in Christian countries for whatever reason. You don't find cases in Asia. You don't find cases in India. You find cases in Africa, but it's mostly rustling. There are some North African cases that are probably ritual cases, shall we say. But predominantly, this is a Western culture, Christian country phenomenon.
And you had mentioned something earlier that I admire, because I think those of us interested in paranormal studies often, you know, you talked about the people who said, well, it's all bunk, 100%. And then you have the people on kind of, quote, our side, who anytime something happens, ah, that must be ET, or there's a light in the sky, we must be being visited, and not acknowledging that some of these things are explicable. As seeing that you've looked at hundreds, probably thousands of these cases by now, do you have a sense of what percentage are explicable through scavenger action, as you said, and other things, and what percentage are just head scratchers?
Well, I can only really look at my own data on that, because obviously, you know, with all these other thousands of cases that have occurred all over the world, I wasn't there.
Sure.
I wasn't privy to, you know, the investigative process or the results from any sort of scientific testing, which is pretty rare. But out of the 200 or so cases that I personally was involved with, 40 of those cases appeared to me to be high strange, in that something or somebody somehow killed the animal, apparently took it somewhere. Oftentimes it appears that these animals are taken elsewhere, you know, mutilated and then brought back. And out of those 40 cases, I would say there was a half a dozen that were truly high strange that I don't think can be explained with modern forensic science. Obviously, 160 cases out there that are left, you know, I think out of those, probably half, so let's say 80 to 100 cases were probably scavenger action. And that leaves us with some equivocal cases, let's say 50 or so, 60 that appeared strange, but could possibly be explained away. And then there's the 40. And out of those 40, there was, you know, 4 to 6 that were just really were freaky.
The one thing that's always fascinated me, supposedly, and let me know if this maps to your experience, the supposed bloodless nature of these mutilations.
Well, you know, again, there's a lot of misconceptions about what happens when an animal dies, or any warm-blooded creature, even cold-blooded creatures, when they die. If they're dead and you cut on them, the heart isn't pumping. There's the blood pressure has subsided, or is gone. And so wounds don't bleed. So if these animals are scavenged and chunks of soft tissue organs, which are the fastest regenerating organs in the body, by the way, when these are taken away, torn out by birds, coyotes, later on maggots and other insects. You're not going to find blood on the cuts. And of course, the blood that is in the body is going, with the help of gravity, of course, descend to the bottom of the body cavity. So an amateur, untrained observer coming along and looking at the animal sees these organs gone. There's no bleeding wounds. There doesn't appear to be blood anywhere. They're going to assume that this animal has been drained of blood. Well, I don't know how many cases I went out on, accompanied by my research help and my brother's Pyrenees dog, Cato, who was always the first one on let loose on the scene. We would often, I don't know how many times I lost track, but the rancher would say, oh, they drained my bestie of blood. And so me and my bro, who's, a big burly guy and works out, we would take the thing and flip it over. And all the, coagulated blood and fluids and whatever moisture was still left in the fluids would come splashing out of the body cavity. It was out of sight, out of mind, until you flip it over and then you see it all come out. So unless you're a veterinary pathologist, which I'm not, and unless you have the proper training to determine tantogenesis or the cause of death and then the cause of the subsequent disfigurement, you're not going to be able to tell with any certainty, definitive, unequivocal certainty, that the animal has been drained of blood. I only have two cases, to my knowledge, that appeared to have been drained of blood and fluids. I mean, the meat was slightly pink, but mostly gray. It appeared like all the blood had been taken out of even some of the smallest capillaries. And, there was just no blood in the body cavity. This one case was discovered in a pristine 5-inch snowfall. And we found one drop of blood on the rear left heel of this calf. Now, that case was drained of blood, but that's one out of 200.
Right.
So, again, I'm not a veterinary pathologist. Unfortunately, I don't, back when I was really actively doing field work, I would rarely get called in time to obtain forensic samples. By the time usually a rancher finds one of these animals, a day, 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, even 5 days have passed. You have to be on site within 24 hours to really gain the kinds of scientific samples and evidence that can then be tested post-mortem. Very rarely do ranchers spend money on a lost investment, bring in a veterinarian to determine what happened to the animal, how it died. Oftentimes veterinarians can be fooled even because they're not, their expertise is keeping animals alive, not studying why they died and were, and in this case, disfigured. So it's a self-nullifying mystery, which makes it even more compelling, I think, because you have so many cards stacked against you in terms of investigating these cases. And it's really difficult to be told of some, these cases in a timely manner.
Well, it's an unbelievably compelling subject, and we're going to talk to Christopher O'Brien about his state-of-the-art work on it, Stalking the Herd. We'll be back right after this on the Paranormal Podcast. It's spring spruce-up time here at the Spooky Studio, so we've been redesigning everything, redesigning jimherold.com and jimherold.net, so if you haven't checked those out, please do. And just this last weekend, we redesigned our email newsletter to give it a great mobile responsive look, so it looks great on a computer, it looks great on a tablet or a smartphone, wherever it might be. We asked for feedback, and it has been nearly unanimous, vastly in favor of the new design. So if you haven't checked it out, go over to jimherold.com, that's jimherold.com, and scroll down, you'll see where you can click and subscribe to my free newsletter. And the cool thing is I've added something else into the mix. Now, I've been drawing every month a winner of a grab bag of paranormal books, randomly drawn, one winner every month from all of the people who subscribe to the newsletter. And that still stands. You can go over there and enter for that drawing and by just signing up, going to jimherold.com and signing up to the newsletter. But now you automatically get a free gift when you sign up. Once you sign up and confirm your email address, you will be sent a link to download a PDF of my favorite campfire story of all time. Now, this is a transcription of my favorite campfire story of all time, and it's not been in any of my books. So you might want to check it out. If you're a fan of the campfire, you can have that and you can spread it along to your friends. It is a great story, and I'm not going to tell you which one it is. You're going to have to sign up to the newsletter. So go over to jimherold.com, scroll down. It should be right below the top post there. There's a banner, a little yellow button. Click here, and you can sign up to get the newsletter. Another thing you should consider if you haven't looked at it lately is jimherold.net, my Paranormal Plus Club. Now, people, I know what they're thinking. They're thinking, Jim, I can go over to jimherold.com and listen to 25 to 30 free shows. Why should I sign up for the Plus Club? And if you're just kind of into this stuff and not really that interested into it, I can understand that line of thought. But if you're into the paranormal and associated topics, you're really missing out, I got to tell you, because you are missing out on over 790 episodes that are not available at jimherold.com. The kind of things you're missing out are over 170 classic campfire episodes, all those great ghost stories you're missing, over 310 classic paranormal podcast episodes that you can't access at the free site, over 310 exclusive plus podcast episodes that you've never been able to access at the free site, those interactive video webinars, the forums, the video meet and greets with me. I think that you'd really love it. Check it out over at jimherold.net, redesigned, much easier to navigate these days. And also, this coming Monday, not only do we have all those on-demand archived webinars, video webinars that we've done on things like the tarot and ghost hunting and lucid dreaming with people like Michelle Belanger, Black Eyed Kids with David Weatherly, but also we have Thomas Fusco joining us Monday night, and he'll be doing a live video webinar on paranormal mechanics, the information paradigm, and the Big Bang. And he has his theory, supergeometry, kind of like grand theory of the paranormal, always a very popular guest, and I think he'll be equally popular on this webinar. Check it out. There's economical monthly and yearly subscriptions available over at jimherold.net. That's jimherold.net. At the top of the page, you could see there's a little yellow button you can click. Same with jimherold.com. You'll find the link there as well. There's a little bit bigger button over at jimherold.com, big yellow button at the top of the site. Check it out. I think that you'll enjoy it. And I know I'm enjoying this episode of the Paranormal Podcast, so let's get back to it. We are joined today by Christopher O'Brien. He is the author of the book, Stalking the Herd. We're looking into the cattle mutilation phenomenon today, and Christopher is the man to speak to about this. His book is 600 pages, and it's crammed with over 1,000 case histories that extend back to 1606. So this certainly isn't anything new, and it certainly is a real mystery. Christopher, something that you talked about before that I've always been interested in is, it's probably like a close second or a distant second to the ET theory, is the idea that the government is doing this. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, again, some of these misnomers that we were mentioning before, one of these is the idea of laser cuts, that these animals are being somehow surgically, these tissues are surgically excised with the aid of high heat or maybe some sort of sci-fi Star Trek particle beam instrument. This is, again, another, I think, very pop culture sort of misnomer that has been promoted by some researchers that really want this to be off-planet and high-strange and ET-derived cases. And, you know, I really recommend a couple of scientific papers that have been done that look at what happens to animal flesh once it's been exposed to the sun. The animal bloats, the areas that have been torn out either by scavengers or cut with a knife or scalpel, when these areas dry out, and when the animal goes back down and the bloat, the gas escapes from the animal, and the animal goes back to its, you know, normal size and even less than its normal size, it starts to become necrotic. The edges of where the organs have been taken out are hard and appear brown. They appear smooth, almost polished. And that, to an untrained eye, can appear to look like it's been burned. Out of the 200 cases that I had, I was able to test about a dozen, 16 of these cases. And out of those, we had indications of high heat in two of the cases, and the other two, it was equivocal. The first thing I do, Jim, when I go out on a case is I look to see if there's cut hair follicles. Mm-hmm. Because when an animal, a scavenger, a bird, whatever, rips out something, let's say rips out the udder or the genitalia, it tears between the hairs, basically. And if you look carefully, and if you see actual, like a straight line of cut hair, that to me is, you know, the number one indication that this animal has been cut with some sort of sharp instrument. The vast, vast majority, 90, let's just take the real cases. Okay, let's forget about the scavenger cases. Let's look at the real high strange cases. I would estimate that 90%, 95% of these cases were cut with a sharp implement. Okay, like a knife or a scalpel. They weren't lased. Okay, back in the 70s, we didn't have the technology to have portable lasers in right. the field. We barely do now. And it takes a lot of passes with a razor to go through cowhide. That's why we use it on the soles of our shoes. It's very tough. And so I think this is a misnomer. And the fact that a majority of these cases, in my estimation, have been cut with a sharp implement points to some sort of human group or human agency. And who has the technology to fly around in helicopters in the night with impunity most times? Perform these surgeries, except for some government groups. So David Perkins, my mentor, who I'm writing a follow-up book to Stalking the Herd with, he's going to help me analyze the first book in the second book. We're going to look at all these theories and see which ones stick. But David pointed out very early on, back in 78, 79, that a large percentage of areas of high incidence appear to be downwind and downstream of where we mine uranium, weaponize uranium, store it, put it into missiles and have missile silos, have nuclear power plants. If you go downwind and downstream of where these facilities are, oftentimes those are the areas of high incidence for the cattle mutilation phenomenon. So he came up with this theory of the environmental monitoring theory. And basically what it states is that there is some group that's interested in monitoring locations in the environment that may have been impacted by above ground and in some cases water table irradiation of the environment. And he's very eloquently stated this. And this particular theory, out of all the theories, has way more evidence to support it than any other theory. And it still has yet to be completely explained and debunked, if you will, or skepticized, or whatever term you want to use. And it still has legs, all these years later. We're talking almost 40 years later. So the environmental monitoring theory obviously would suggest some sort of government group or like some secret James Bond CDC outfit or NIH, National Institute of Health. It appears that we're seeing a monitoring of the environment through the analysis of soft tissue organs of animals that graze in that environment. Now, I think it may have dovetailed into other environmental monitoring, which opens up a whole new can of worms, and that is the potential for mad cow disease to be in the food chain and people within certain governmental agencies that are very concerned about that.
And certainly that is something to be concerned about. Actually, I'm probably one of the few people who had my wife's aunt died of Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease about 20 years ago. And it is a frightening, frightening disease because one day you're here and not too far on, you're gone. And it's just like that. And the idea that you could eat something and then 30 years later have it kill you, incubating in you all those years, truly frightening.
Yeah, and this is not a story that you're going to hear much about. And I find it very, very interesting that Colm Kelleher, a microbiologist who was a managing director for the National Institute for Discovery Sciences, NIDS, for many years, wrote a very, very good book that I think really deserved a lot more attention than it got, called Brain Trust. And here is a PhD microbiologist looking at the mutilation phenomenon and seeing parallels with mutilation cases in and around areas where mad cow disease, chronic wasting disease, and scrapie in sheep. Of course, chronic wasting disease is mad deer or elk disease. Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease is mad human disease. They're all forms of transmissible spongiform encephalopathy, which is a misfolded protein that's able to kick off and cause other proteins to misfold. The end result being you have holes developing in nerve tissue and in the brain. You lose motor function, your memory, you twitch out. And oftentimes your brain forgets to tell its the body to breathe, and pneumonia develops, and people die from other you know, attendant problems because of the transmissible spongiform encephalopathy, or TSE, if you will. And Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease was originally thought to only spontaneously occur in nature in 1 in a million people. A recent study out of England has dropped that number to 1 in every 2,000 people. So we're seeing an interesting increase in these TSE-related afflictions within the human population. And we're also seeing an incredible increase in dementia deaths and Alzheimer's deaths. Many of the symptoms of Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease or mad cow disease in humans is mirrored in the types of symptoms that you see in dementia and Alzheimer's deaths. And I've been approached by another microbiologist named Tyler Kochjohn, who studies Alzheimer's and is very interested in some of these parallels. But we've seen a 6,000% increase in the last 20 years of people that are dying of symptoms that look like dementia and Alzheimer's and possibly Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease. So this could be a really bombshell health crisis that may be looming on the horizon here. It's already started, it appears. And so it's going to take I'm not a scientist, so you know, I trust the expertise of people that know a heck of a lot more about this than I do. I don't want to make misstatements about this stuff, but Tyler Kochjohn is very interested in this whole realm, and I think the next book is really going to dive into some of these potential health concerns that the cattle mutilation mystery may be involved with.
Frightening stuff. Now, here's a question for you, and this is kind of out there, but you talk about the relation between man and cattle, particularly in the Western world. As you said, this doesn't happen in Asia in some areas. Could this be some kind of strange cosmic feedback loop that we're getting, that this is a sign of how we're treating cattle? I know that seems kind of out there, but is something like that possible?
Absolutely. It's not only possible. According to David Perkins and his theorizing, he's a very smart guy. He's got a master's from Yale. We're not talking about some yahoo who just is spouting off for the sake of hearing himself talk. He's been studying this for 40 years and very, very bright, excellent researcher. He has also come up with this idea that perhaps because we know collectively on an unconscious level as humans, that cattle are extremely detrimental to the environment. They are the largest source of freshwater pollution. They are the single biggest cause for the creation of deserts. They're the main reason why we're cutting down the rainforest to make room for more cattle. They're the second largest producers, natural producers of ozone depleting gases. Cows burp and fart every 2 minutes. And 1.37 billion farting cows creates a lot of gas. Cattle are detrimental to the environment, when especially if they're crammed together on feedlots by the tens of thousands. And there is a possibility that collectively humankind knows this, and especially in the West. And there's a possibility that this may be a form of spontaneously occurring cultural stigmata that we're trying to warn ourselves on, you know, welling up from the unconscious. We're attempting to warn ourselves away from furthering this slippery slope that cattle are helping pull us down. And I think that there's a lot of very suggestive, there are indications that there may be something high strange and collectively manifested going on. And David's idea of this kind of cultural stigmata, I think, is an idea that has not been fully addressed and looked at by investigators and researchers.
Something that I wonder about anytime we talk about any paranormal field of endeavor are hoaxes. How many of these do you think are intentionally staged to get the attention of the National Enquirer or YouTube or whatever it is these days?
Well, I think very, very few, if any. This would be an extremely unlikely scenario. However, red herring cases, let's say real cases occur and one of the groups, I think there's multiple groups going at it here. There's multiple agendas. There's no one size fits all answer, but let's say that some real high strange cases occur, the kinds of cases that are least likely to be reported by ranchers. Mm-hmm. Okay. The weirder the case, the less likely the rancher will admit to it. He'll just drag it off and bury it or put it on his bone pile, whatever. Let's say that some real cases occur. Generally, what you see is right after that, you'll see around that area, you'll see some pretty sophisticated, slick, what appear to be human perpetrated cases. And then if the media gets involved, generally, then you'll find 40 miles away this way, 40 miles away that way, 40 miles, 50 miles away this way. You'll see what appear to be sloppier cases that are like red herring cases. So are these hoaxes? Are these cases that are performed and perpetrated to keep investigators and law enforcement running around, divert their attention to red herring cases? Well, forget the left hand. Let's go watch what the right hand is doing. You know, that type of thing. Sleight of hand, if you will, magician type jargon. If you want to include those as hoax cases, as purposefully perpetrated to keep people spinning their wheels and running around wasting their time, yeah, I think that hoax cases occur. If you're talking about a bunch of college kids that go out and they want to mutilate a cow, I don't think so. You have to be, number one, really sick and demented to even think about something like that. And number two, you have to have an amoral sense about you. It's one thing to go out and try to tip a cow over when it's sleeping, standing on its feet. It's another thing to go out, tackle the thing, kill it, and then disfigure it. I think there's very, very few cases that could be described in that fashion.
But you do feel that there is definitely a component of disinformation surrounding this.
Red herring cases, absolutely, and I've seen it myself. I also think there's cases where these red herring cases where they actually take people out and try to train them to do these procedures. I've seen cases where you have the first half of the incision and the excision, I should say, it looks extremely professional. It's like they handed the scalpel to a trainee and then he tried to do it and he gets around to a certain point and stops. And then the instructor goes, no, you do it like this, and zips the rest of it out. Huh. So, you know, I hate to say this, but, you can't look at a photograph or you can't read a police report or a sheriff's report or, read an article in the newspaper to ascertain much of anything when it comes to a particular case of this type. You literally have to be up to speed enough to know what to look for, to really be aware of all sorts of possibilities that could be at play. And because, I was able to work with law enforcement, was able to get instruction from some scientists and veterinarians and others in law enforcement, proper crime scene investigation techniques. It's easier for me, I think, than the average person to look at a case, in person and ascertain, as an amateur, ascertain at least certain things that the average person wouldn't be able to. That's only because I've done it enough and I've been instructed to some degree in what to look for and how to look for it. So it's virtually impossible for the average person to read about something like read Stalking the Herd and take a case and look at it and determine who was responsible or what was responsible for the disfigurement and death of the animal.
Interesting. Well, again, very compelling stuff, interesting stuff, a lot more than we can cover in 30 or 40 minutes. That's why they should pick up the book. So here's your cue, Chris. Right. Here's your cue. Where can people follow the work that you're doing in general, and where can they pick up the book?
Well, I have a website, Our Strange Planet. It's a strange planet. It's ourstrangeplanet.com. And also I do have a dedicated site for the book, stalkingtheherd.com, one word. And also, as you mentioned at the top of the show, Jim, I am a co-host of The Paracast. It's theparacast.com. We air every Sunday night. We cover all these subjects and many more, just like you do, Jim. And if you're interested in this whole scenario, do contact me through my website, and I'll be happy to further your educational process if I have time.
Any further final thoughts that you'd like to leave with our audience about this phenomenon of cattle mutilation?
Don't believe everything that people with foregone conclusions and agendas have to say about this. You need to be as open-minded, objective, and unbiased as possible to really have any chance to make heads or tails, you know, over what may be the greatest serial crime spree in history, you know?
Well, it's certainly been an interesting journey today, and thank you for taking us through it, Chris O'Brien. Check out his book, fascinating stuff, Stalking the Herd. And thank you for joining us today on the Paranormal Podcast. We certainly appreciate it. Hope you enjoyed the program. We'll see you back next week. Bye-bye. Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com, and thanks for listening.